City Talk 105.9 official podcasts online at citytalk.fm.
This is Talk to Trisha on City Talk 105.9.
Eek! It's the 11th of January already, and for many of us that means we've just spent our first full week back at work. So how was it for you? Well, hopefully not too much of a shock to the system. Well, according to reports this week, if you've made it through the last few days without any major confrontations or aggro, you should give yourself a pat on the back. Some experts say that early January is one of the most stressful times of the year. Now, it's hardly surprising when you think about it, is it? You've got that cocktail of cold weather, economic gloom, and the end of the holidays. It's not exactly a recipe for peace and harmony, is it? So how do you deal with stress in work or elsewhere in your life? According to new research released last week, over a third of Brits admit to having a screaming tantrum when they're stressed, while just one in 10 of us prefer to sit quietly in silence when the going gets tough. That'd be my husband, like a bear with a sore head. And it gets worse. According to the survey, the things most likely to stress us out include the sound of work colleagues eating noisily, someone sniffing, sighing, or talking too loudly on the phone. So what's the best way of dealing with that kind of behaviour and our own responses to it? Well, Judy James has a lot of experience of dealing with stressful situations in confined spaces. After all, she's a behaviour expert who studies the housemates on Big Brother's Little Brother, and she's also a dab hand at stress management. Judy, welcome to City Talk.
Hello, Tricia. Thank you.
OK, let's start with the basics. What is stress?
That's actually is a very good place to start, as Julie Andrews once said, because most of us talk about stress, but we don't really know what we mean by it, and we all mean different things by stress. Stress is a point where your brain is telling your body that it's in fight or flight survival mode. So bad stress, which is what most of us suffer from in some shape or form, is almost a physiological problem. We're probably being faced by a situation that is no more dangerous than some of the things you mentioned, like somebody's eating noisily next to you. But the messages that come subliminally from the brain to the body will be the same as if we were being threatened by, say, a wild bear or something like that. And so what happens is our body goes into fight or flight mode. It gears up. Now, in natural circumstances, those would be very good responses. So your heart rate will increase, your breathing will increase, you'll start to sweat, you'll find that your muscles will all tense up. And all of that, if we were being attacked, would help us to save our lives. But when it's just somebody sniffing next to you and you're getting all those responses, they become less than helpful. And if that response gets triggered off on a regular basis, you start to suffer from unpleasant symptoms that can be sort of almost full time.
Now, Judy, you said bad stress. So does it follow that there's good stress?
I must admit, most doctors don't like me to use the term good stress, but I do need to use it because I think sometimes we get very scared of stress. And I work with people that say, I just want a stress-free life. But in actual fact, it's an evolutionary response. And it's quite good to see that under the right circumstances, it is a good thing. And also, I deal a lot with what's called the stress curve, which I think helps people to understand that some of us like to be put under more pressure than others, you know. So for some people, and I'm a bit of a drama queen, you know, so I like being busy. I like a lot of pressure. I like emergencies and panic.
Yeah, me too.
And if I haven't got one, I'll create one as famously. But with a lot of people, if you thrive under that level of pressure, then you won't get stressed, except when you're doing it for too long or it starts to tell too much on you or you lose control of the circumstances. But other people just like a quiet life. They don't like a lot of pressure. So it will vary for everybody. But
so one person's stressful situation is another person's doddle. But when you say that if you're under bad stress, the effects of bad stress are with you for too long, what sort of side effects do start showing themselves?
Well, it's a good idea for most people to be aware of the smaller symptoms when they start to kick in. And they can be anything from most people know what it feels like to get a stress headache, for instance. Or you might find that you're not sleeping quite as well as you normally would do. Or it could be intellectual. I find that I forget things, and I don't know if you've ever done it where you sort of you try and think of your burglar alarm number or your mobile phone number somebody asks you, and you think, can I find a friend because I can't remember? or you're trying to read the newspaper and you find that you keep jumping from one feature to another. You can't concentrate on things.
Right. Or
it could be that you start to get the negative emotions start to get exaggerated, so you get unusually snappy or tearful or just ratty.
Oh, teenagers at exam time.
Well, and all of us, really. I mean, you know, I don't know. Sometimes you go home from work and your other half says, would you like a cup of tea? Tea, don't ask me to make a decision. Yeah. It's like you've suddenly got very snappy over very little. But the trouble is you see everything as being a problem when you start to get stressed. And then if you're not careful, you can become what I call a stress martyr, which means that you're
stress
not able
martyr.
To... Well, I think you will recognise this syndrome because you'll know people that do this if you don't do it yourself. You actually work for a long period being very busy under a lot of pressure and you handle a lot of things. But then you find that you can't let it drop. So, for instance, the day when you go home and you think, I'm going to relax for the weekend, you suddenly start finding yourself painting the lounge or, you know, you have 200 people around for dinner or something like that. So it's almost as though you...
But what's wrong with... But what's wrong with it? I mean, you're talking to the person who, you know, after a few days of being in the house, not working, I have to rearrange the office and refile everything, what have you. So I asked somewhat defensively, what is wrong with, you know, keeping those stress levels elevated? Is there a point where if you keep them elevated for too long, something dire occurs?
It doesn't have to. And I'm often arguing with people because, I mean, for instance, I get up early. I start at 5 o'clock even when I'm not working. I like to be busy. I'm just discussing. I don't take holidays. And I wouldn't advise anybody else to work like that. But it suits me. And I think if you genuinely know it suits you, but at the same time, I will always just have a little bit of a finger on the pulse to find out because we do change. And it could be, for instance, that maybe you've got more stress at home suddenly and you find that that affects the way that your coping levels are at work. So I think you, however, whatever you think you're like or wherever you think you are on the stress curve, it's always worthwhile just keeping an eye on yourself, really, so that you can identify quite quickly when it stops being good stress and it starts to become less than helpful stress. Because once you start to go down that slide that's going towards negative stress, it's very hard to get back up again.
Now, do you think the Brits are particularly stressed out as a nation?
I don't think particularly more than others. I mean, we've always had this stiff upper lip thing that has tended to
But do you
make
think
us...
that creates more stress, being
well,
a stiff upper lip?
That is an interesting question because there's been sort of therapists for years have come up with this thing, no, you mustn't be like that, you should let it all hang out, you should tell people how you're feeling, you should cry, you should be more emotional, everything like that. And then suddenly, and I think sadly, just as the Brits have woken up and started to let it all hang out a little bit, and, you know, famously it was Diana's funeral, wasn't it, when we started to sort of allow emotions out in public. And now they're beginning to say, as usual, you know, actually we might have been wrong. And for some people, and again, not for everybody, but for some people, that not bottling up particularly, but not discussing, not going to therapy, not talking it all out to everybody, it actually suits some people. Some people are better working their way through it and ignoring it.
So when I did the introduction there, I talked about those little things that drive people mad and the survey that said things likely to stress us out. I mean, work colleagues eating noisily or sniffing or sighing or talking to it's that sounds really pathetic. Can something that small be stressful?
This is all, I mean, isn't it awful when you think that somebody sniffing, and boy, there's a lot of sniffing around with all the flu in the car at the moment, but that can actually trigger off a response in you that in primeval times would have been your response to being attacked by a saber-toothed tiger.
Why?
But that's exactly what happens. There's two words that connect with stress. One is control. So we tend to be more open to stress when we feel that we've got no control over what we're doing, which is why when you go to companies, people always assume that it's the people at the top of the company that would have the highest stress levels.
Right.
In fact, it's usually middle management that don't have as much control over what they do and are answerable to everybody. And the other word, though, is perception. And I think part of understanding stress is to understand that it's physiological, it's wonky perception. And it doesn't matter how many times you say to yourself, this is just somebody eating noisily. I mean, the other day I was in the five items only queue in a supermarket, sadly, counting the basket in front and bending slightly to see that there were six. And I was getting so angry and stressed. And I had to say to myself, yeah, it's not a lion. It's not going to kill you. Life's too short. And I talked myself out of it. But you can understand why people do blow a fuse. It's not that they're actually stressing about. It's the backpack of big issues that we carry with us, and you listed a lot of them at the start of the item.
The lack of control.
And these are the triggers. These are the triggers that set it off.
But do you think there is any truth in the idea that modern society is more stressful than days gone by, or have we just identified that that's what's going on?
Well, it does sound perverse, doesn't it? Because if you go back, any generation before mine have always had real things to stress about. I mean, my parents went through the war. You know, their parents went through two wars. There's been illnesses around. You know, I mean, years ago, if you had an operation, it would have killed you. I mean, people used to lose children. And suddenly we seem to have it, what I'm sure our ancestors would have said, very cushy comparatively. Yeah. And yet we are suffering from higher stress levels. And I think part of that, and this has never been medically proven, but a part of that, there does seem to be a situation, a scenario, which is previously their stress has been very much focused on what I would call basics. And they're basics that we don't tend to have to worry about. So
things like just staying alive.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we don't have to worry about, and I'm making assumptions, but generally we don't have to worry about where food's coming from. You know, we don't have to go out and hunt for our food. You know, illnesses, yes, but, you know, daily illnesses are not going to be too bad. And, you know, we don't expect to lose children. We don't expect to get into a war. So it's almost as though we've lost the focus for genuine fear and we're applying it to trivia.
But do you think the other thing is that we have that past generations didn't have is the media? Because if you were in a small village, your stresses would be usually around what was happening in your immediate vicinity. Yeah, you might get the odd dispatch from war. But now we're bombarded with the world is a scary place type messages. Do you think that increases our can't let the kids go out to play in case a paedophile comes along and, you know, maybe there are terrorists living next door to Alice and all this sort of thing? Do you think that backdrop tends to help be, I don't know, a loudspeaker for smaller stressors?
Well, absolutely. And I mean, as you know, the media, particularly with the newspapers, and I mean, I love them to bits, but they do sell more copy by scaring us. And, you know, it will be something that's not a huge threatening problem for most people, but by the time you've read enough about it, you do feel that you identify with it somewhere along the line, and then you start to worry about it. And of course, once we start to worry, worrying is very destructive and it's pretty pointless usually. And again, as I said, we're not worrying for the right reasons. I mean, our predecessors would have worried and then done something about it. But we tend to be more in a generation now where we just worry. We kind of marinate in the worry and often there's nothing we can do about it. I mean, people
are now what
worrying
do you
about recession.
Yes, exactly. That's the point. What do you do to stop worrying about things, big things like the recession and about, you know, what ifs? Because that it's that what if thinking that will drive you crazy. How do you stop worrying about those things?
I mean, I normally have two steps. Don't get me wrong, I'm not one of these smug people that knows every answer, because I know that if you worry, and I wake up 3 o'clock in the morning sometimes, I think, why am I worrying about this? But it just seems to happen. But it's very good to start to take practical steps. Now, every problem has only got three potential solutions, and it's good to sit down and create order out of chaos by writing them down. So write the problem, write the thing that's worrying you down at the top of the page, and then look at your three potential solutions. One would be to take action and work to resolve it. And if you decide to do that, then you can start working on a strategy. The second step is that you might decide that you can't do anything about it, in which case it's worthwhile letting it drop, and that means really letting it drop. The third step is the one that most people in the UK choose, which is whinging. And unfortunately, that's the one not to go for. I always say,
whinging
like
poms.
Picking a scab, the more you pick it, it won't heal. So although it makes you feel a bit better to sort of whinge and complain to everybody, doing it on a serial basis. I mean, I think now, as dreadful as the recession is, I have to say, I think we're almost getting fed up hearing about it now.
I
think that word credit crunch, people are saying, if I hear those words anymore, I'm going to scream. And that's the problem.
Yeah.
Unless there's something useful to be done about it, to just keep discussing it is going to keep the pain going. So you need to either start to take steps or let it drop or stop whinging.
All right, let me just remind people you're listening to Talk to Tricia here on City Talk 105.9, and I'm talking to Judy James about stress. Now, one of your other areas of expertise is body language, because I know I see You magazine amongst many others where you analyse body language. You used to be a model, didn't you?
I know. I've had an odd backward route in my career, actually. I've always, though, been a writer, so I've always written articles and books, and there was a massive crossover, believe it or not, between the two. And I used to go to schools as well to train school leavers on job interview techniques. And
right.
This was years ago. I mean, there was, I think, only Desmond Morris doing anything on body language, and he came at it very much from
the animal
point of view.
Yeah.
He's a biologist. And I just more and more thought this is actually to do with body language. I'm sure this is more important than makeup and hairdos and clothing and things like that. So I wrote something about it, and it really took off, and I got asked to write a book about it, then to do more lectures, and then I started to study it. So I kind of worked backwards, and it just was the one subject that jumped out the pack as being very popular with people. So,
well,
22 books later now, I think.
22 books?
I know. I have to say it, because I keep forgetting.
Well, yeah, I just think about, and people might have come across your articles where you look at a photograph of, say, two celebrities on it, hugging, walking, or conversing, and read their body language. But can you do that through one photo? I mean, or do you actually see more than the one photo? Do you sort of pick up a general picture of what that celebrity might be like by looking at many pictures?
Yeah, I mean, I've usually not been tracking, but obviously keeping abreast of that person for many years and through many photographs and things like that. Mm. I mean, normally when I take one photograph, I mean, if you read the way that I write it, I'm usually slightly tongue-in-cheek. But,
yes,
I mean,
yeah,
there is a lot of truth, but it's done in quite a humorous way as well. But no, it's usually done on a background of knowledge of what their life's doing and where they're going and things like that. But even so, I actually surprise myself sometimes at how accurate readings like that can be. And I mean, I wouldn't ever, I mean, for instance, I've often been asked to do things like helping the police look at a criminal and say whether I think they're guilty or not. I would never, ever do anything like that, because I always say, and it's always on page 1, 2, or 3 of any book that I write, it is not a precise science.
No.
It's more of a reading between the lines thing. And the thing that people do need to be careful about if they're doing it for real is the fact that it's very easy to make an error between looking at the symptoms and putting them to the wrong cause. For instance, I mean, I know when I go out shopping, I mean, I'm as honest as the day's long, but I don't know if you've ever gone into a shop and found the store detective was watching you and been unable to pull off innocent body language after that. I mean, I immediately look as guilty as hell. I could not thieve anything if I wanted to, but just the fact I'm being watched changes my body language, so I instantly look like a criminal or something. So that's based on honesty rather than any guilt that's going on. So you need to always keep in mind that, particularly with some of the bigger figures, that there could be
something
else going on, completely different side to what's going on.
But do you over the years have you looked at, because the whole thing of celebrity, or a lot of the part of celebrity is acting a certain role, and do you study when you've seen body language of certain celebrities come up time and time again, think, you know, who they are or who they seem to be and who they are portraying are two different things?
Yes, I mean, I like looking at the different layers like that, because, I mean, obviously a lot of the photographs are red carpet photographs, and people will put on, somebody's held a camera up in front of them, they put on a performance. And I like looking at the difference between what I call the performed signals, and particularly when they're with partners and things like that, and they obviously want to make a performance, this is what our relationship is like, this is how we want the public to perceive
I'm
our
thinking the Beckhams. I'm thinking the Beckhams here, Judy, I'm thinking the Beckhams.
Yes.
Don't know why.
Do you know what, though, with the Beckhams? I have to say that the more I study them, I'm not sure much of it is a lie. I mean, they do genuinely. They're concealed gestures. And when I say concealed, the things that you get sort of when you look at the leakage gestures.
Yeah.
They do seem to show that they're generally quite happy together. You know, I can understand why they've stayed together for as long as They have done. The ones I love, though, are the ones that always announce their love. You know, we are so in love. This is my ideal person. You can
like
set a stopwatch as to how quickly that relationship is going to break down.
I could ask you, like, but let's move on to this year's Celebrity Big Brother. It's now underway. Ulrika Johnson and I should remember the little guy, but Coolio and
Vern,
yeah, LaToya, etc. Now, do you think there are any secrets to success in the house, or do you think it's just they might start off like we've heard about Vern saying he's going to do this and he's going to do that and what have you, but they might start off with these grand plans, but when it comes down to it, Desmond Morris, like, we're all just a bunch of animals in a cage.
Well, and that's what I think always seems to surprise them, the fact that they go in and I think they always think that they're strong enough to present themselves in a way to make sure that they will come out and go into Panto or get whatever it was, a hit record or something like that. A lot of people, I've known them go in, like Leo Sayer. I don't know if you remember when he went into the Celebrity One.
Ran over the wall, didn't he?
What a nice person I am. And I mean, how many days or hours was it did it take before he turned feral? You know, it's interesting because I think none of us really understand ourselves. I think we are a sum of parts that we kind of work with. But, you know, to say I'm going to be myself in there, my argument normally is, what is yourself? Because yourself is very related to the people around you. And those people will not be in there with you. You'll be in with a load of strangers, a lot of people that are playing the same game as well. And I would defy most people to be able to keep up an act for certainly the length of time that the normal public go in there for. And I have to say that the normal public punters are a lot stronger and more resilient than the celebrities, because the celebrities...
Are they?
Oh, absolutely. They know the game now. They're like little...
But celebrities also tend to be more, in general, I generalise here, but more pampered and have been told nice things about themselves and kept in a slightly more rarefied atmosphere one way or the other. They've probably forgotten, well, if they ever had street smarts, they've probably long since gone. So that, I'm thinking, would make them more vulnerable to stress.
Well, that, I mean, that is the point, because, I mean, if you look at them now in there, and they've only been there a little while now, a lot of them seem totally bewildered by the whole experience. It's as though somebody sold them the wrong... I mean, LaToya, sadly, said, this is the best thing I've ever done in my life. And I thought, I will ask you that again in 3 weeks' time.
Or a week?
Or 3 hours' time. You know, and still not quite getting the fact that she's on camera either. And I love the quote from Tommy, the shouting Scotsman, who said that his best friend George Galloway recommended that he should go in there. I mean, George Galloway completely unraveled in there. I mean, he almost...
His best friend.
Destroyed his career. He's advising his friends to go in.
Well, alleged friends. You wonder if, did he have a pantomime wicked grin on there?
It's like the best friend that says you should eat that box of chocolates because you're getting gaunt, you know. It's like, not your best friend. I just think this lot, above all of the celebrity ones that have gone in there, I'm amazed they just don't seem to get it. And that's why I think somebody like Michelle, who's a bit of a veteran of the circuit, although she might not be popular for that reason, I think she might be a survivor in there, actually. I think people might start liking her by the end of it. I could almost see her winning.
Do you think, my children pointed out, I mean, my children, you have to remember, have a psychotherapist father and a mental health person as a mother. But the first thing my children said when they saw Vern was manipulative. He's always been used to getting his own way through manipulating his lack of height and manipulating situations. It's going to be very interesting to see how long the others will indulge that.
Well, and also, and I don't know if you saw the last Ordinary Big Brother where they had Mikey, the blind guy,
was in there.
It was almost a litmus test for the others that they kind of fell on the sword or not, because they're all aware that it shouldn't be seen as a handicap, and I think Vern's already reminded them. But then, as they said, and I think they're in a complete quandary now, because if they don't offer to help him, they're going to look cold and unfeeling. But if they do offer to help him, they're going to sound, and Lucy in particular has started to do it, hugely patronising, because the way that Vern looks, every time he walks across the room, you can hear somebody go, oh, isn't he sweet? And you think, no, actually,
poor Davina even said that, didn't she?
I know, it just must be. And then afterwards, you just wish you hadn't said it. And as you say, he will quite readily remind people. But there again, if you're watching somebody struggle, it's human nature to offer to help them. So that's going to be interesting as well. And again, there is an almost an educational side to Big Brother these days. I think when Pete with Tourette's went in there, I know from experience that that was a great move for people with Tourette's.
Yes, it was.
They suddenly went, everybody suddenly understood what was going on, much more readily accepted, etc., etc. So, you know, that's a nice
angle. Saw the person first before any perceived disability. So who are you tipping to win then, Michelle?
Well, that's me taking a very long punt, actually. I mean, I know everybody's saying Verne, but I don't like this idea that just because he's small that he's naturally going to be the nicest guy in there. Again, I think that's quite patronising anyway.
And prejudicial, yeah.
So I was looking at Coolio, but I think he's kind of coming out with a few rich phrases that might not win him any fans. So, yeah, in a weird way, I'm thinking Michelle.
OK, now, the research released last week that I mentioned earlier, that was commissioned by the RNLI, for those people who are listening who don't know. That's the Royal National Lifeboat Institute. Now, it's a surprising combination, isn't it, that research and the RNLI? Why?
It does sound it, but there is a link there. I mean, they are a brilliant charity, as you know. I mean, they have funding. I didn't realise until I read the statistics, they rescue an average of 21 people a day, which is quite amazing, really. And they do every year, they do an annual what they call SOS fundraiser, which is great fun, and it's on the 30th of January this year.
Right.
And this year, the SOS stands for Sound or Silence, or actually they're calling it Sea of Stress as well, and I think that does link to how most of us are feeling right now. So we're looking for a lifebelt in the stress that we're in. And what they're looking at is people being sponsored for things that would be stress-busting, but you can use them for sponsorship as well. So things like, for fundraising, sponsored screaming. Now, I'm really liking the sound of that one. So
you can do that in the house, Big Brother house, sponsored screaming. That you should. Wow, that'd be grand, wouldn't it? Sponsored screaming.
Actually, that is a really good idea.
There you go.
But also sponsored silence. So if people just
that would be good in the Big Brother house as well.
Stress in a more silent way. But the one I'm really, really thinking that I'll go for, sponsored sea shanties. I love the idea of that.
Life on an ocean wave.
Now, you see, you have just completely confirmed what I've been saying to people. We all have a subliminal sea shanty that we know because
we
were all taught one at school.
Yes.
And there will be one there somewhere.
There absolutely will be. So any one of those could be introduced to the Big Brother house with devastating... I'm just thinking of LaToya screaming.
or Coolio doing a sea shanty in rap style.
In rap, that would be an interesting one. All right, so we should tell people that the Sound or Silence poll has been released, as you said, in the run-up to SOS Day 2009, which takes place on the 30th of January, is that right?
There is, and there's a website that if people want to have a look at the sponsorships and find out more, which is www.rnli.org.uk/SOS.
Okay, so people should get involved because I'm sure a lot of people didn't realise the RNLI get no government funding and 21 people a day that they go out there and rescue, and maybe, you know, a few more people in the Big Brother house or need rescuing. Try and swim away. Judy, thank you so much for your time here City Talk. It's been great talking to you. I'll keep reading your columns. They're fascinating if you've come across Judy's articles. You're listening to Talk to Tricia here on City Talk 105.9. Of course, the voice of Liverpool.
Listen, and log on to the voice of Liverpool. City Talk 105.9.